Good evening. I'm Richard Cheese, and you're lounging against the machine on Time Travel with Chris Earle on 91.5 FM WMFO in Medford.
Kellogg's Pep, the super delicious cereal, presents
The Adventures of Superman.
Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman!
Yes, it's Superman. And today, the Man of Steel tells a story, a wondrous story of the planet Krypton and how he, Superman, came to Earth. Almost a year ago, as some of you will remember, a flaming meteor fell out of the sky and landed in an open field in a suburb of Metropolis. Brought to the Metropolis Museum by Dr. John Whistler, a famous meteorologist, it was discovered to be a piece of kryptonite, a fragment of the shattered planet Krypton. Sent to interview Dr. Whistler at the museum, Clark Kent, in reality Superman, discovered to his horror that if he approached within a distance of 10 feet of the strange green glowing meteor, he lost all his strength. Panic-stricken, he influenced Whistler to seal the meteor in a private vault. But now the meteorologist is dead, and Kent is fearful lest the vault be opened and the dangerous piece of kryptonite fall into strange hands. As we continue now, Lois Lane and editor Perry White are at Kent's apartment, where Kent is about to tell them why he seems so worried. Listen.
This is a strange story you're about to hear. I just hope I can trust you to let it go no further.
No, don't be a fool, Kent. What is it?
Well, it concerns Superman.
Superman?
Yes. As you may or may not know, Superman was the only survivor of the planet Krypton when it exploded in space many years ago. He came to Earth as an infant and grew up to discover that he had strange and unusual powers. I mean, he had impenetrable skin and tremendous strength and the ability to withstand fire and flame. He also had the power to leap great distances and to sustain himself in midair. Perhaps I better go back and tell you the whole story, huh?
What story?
The story of how Superman came to Earth, Chief.
What? Well, how do you know that, Clark?
I'll explain later, Lois. First, I want to take you on a far journey, millions of miles from the Earth, where, not so many years ago, the planet Krypton burned like a wondrous star in the heavens. Here, civilization was far advanced. It had brought forth a race of supermen, men and women like ourselves, but advanced to the absolute peak of human perfection.
Yes?
As we near Krypton, we see high walls and gleaming turrets. We approach the magnificent Temple of Wisdom with its dome of pure crystal shimmering like a diamond in the sun. There, in a great marble hall, Jor-El, Krypton's leading man of science, is about to address a special meeting of the planet's governing council.
Council members, I have completed my solar calculations, and much as I dread uttering these fateful words, I have come to the conclusion that Krypton is doomed.
Gentlemen, 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 hear him out.
Let me try and explain, gentlemen. The sun is gradually drawing Krypton closer to it. Within a month, possibly only a week, the gravitational pull will be so tremendous that Krypton will not be able to weather the strain. And then our planet will explode like a giant bubble, destroying every living thing on it.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, assuming for the moment, Jor-El, that what you say is true, how are we to avoid this catastrophe facing us? How can we stop it?
It cannot be stopped, Roseanne. It's a force of nature that even we, who are supermen, are powerless to prevent. But there is one way to escape.
Escape? What do you mean?
As you know, I've been working these many months on a model of a spaceship, which, in its final form, is designed to carry the entire population of Krypton to another planet. If you will assign to me 1,000 skilled workmen, I will endeavor to construct the spaceship before the end comes.
It is all well and good, Jor-El, to speak of spaceships, but where would we go?
To the planet Earth. My studies tell me this planet has an atmosphere almost identical with our own.
Jor-El, you have been working too hard. You need a rest. Believe me, we have the utmost respect for your knowledge and integrity, but this is too much. Planets as large as Krypton do not explode.
Wait! Wait, do you hear that, gentlemen?
I hear only a distant thunder.
It is not thunder, Roseanne. That's an internal eruption gas exploding in giant pockets. You're listening to the forewarning of doom. Quakes like that are sounding the death knell of Krypton. It will happen, gentlemen, and happen soon. And when the last great eruption comes...
When it comes, Jor-El, we will all be ready for it. If Krypton is to perish, we will perish with it. But I assure you, Jor-El, your beard will be long enough to trip over before that time arrives.
Very well, laugh if you wish, Roseanne. Laugh, all of you. But a time will come, and that time is perhaps very close at hand, when you'll wish you had heeded the words of Jor-El.
Order, gentlemen, order. Members of the Governing Council, you have heard Jor-El speak. Is it your wish that we devote time and energy to build a spaceship in order, as Jor-El suggests, the entire population of Krypton be transported to the planet known as the Earth?
No!
All in favor, say aye. The Council has spoken, Jor-El.
Yes, and signed the death warrant of every living thing on Krypton. There remains only one thing for me to do. Prepare for the salvation of my wife, Lara, my infant son, and myself. As for the rest of you, may God have mercy on your soul.
Leaving the Temple of Wisdom with the mocking laughter of the council members ringing in his ears, Jor-El hurried to the terrace of his hilltop home and feverishly set to work on the steel model of his spaceship. Time was short, as he alone knew. A matter of days, possibly only hours. Driving home the last rivet, he stepped back to examine the bullet-shaped spaceship, only to discover his young wife standing behind him.
Oh, Lara, I didn't hear you come out.
You were too intent on your work. What did the council say, Jor-El?
They laughed at me, Lara. Marked me for a fool.
Even Roseanne?
Oh, he above all. But no matter. The model is finished now, and tomorrow at dawn I'll send it on its way, watching its flight through the high-powered telescope on the observatory roof. And once I have proven to myself that it works, I will begin building a spaceship large enough to carry all three of us to the planet Earth.
Jor-El, I feel faint. It seems to have grown oppressively hot. Is that because we're being drawn closer to the sun?
Yes, there's a strange glow on the western sky. I don't like it. Where is Kal-El?
Asleep. I had quite a time with him. He was restless all day. Jor-El, what was that?
An internal quake. A bad one.
Jor-El, the house is shaking.
Easy, Lara, easy.
What's happening?
It may pass over. You'd better go in.
No. No, my place is with you. Jor-El, look. The sky, it's darkening.
Lara, this is the end. Krypton is breaking apart.
Jor-El!
We'll return in a moment to find out what happened on the planet Krypton.
Well, here I am back again, Pep Gang, to tell you all about the wonderful offer Kellogg's Pep has for you, in case you missed this big news before. Yes, sirree, gang, Kellogg's Pep has really outdone itself this time. It's offering you the smartest-looking all-aluminum sundial wristwatch you ever saw, with a real strap. Now, wherever you are in the sun, this terrific time teller will give you the hour of the day. In a minute, I'm going to tell you how you can get this one, but let me tell you all about it first. This sundial wristwatch lies flat on your wrist until you're ready to use it. Then, you just lift the shadow hand or pointer and aim it due north. And presto, you have the time of day just by seeing where the pointer's shadow falls on the dial. Why, could anything be easier? And this handsome sundial wristwatch is about the size of the usual wristwatch. Now, here's how you get one. Just send two box tops marked top from two packages of that super delicious whole wheat flake cereal, Kellogg's Pep, along with 10 cents in cash and your name and address, clearly printed to Superman, Box 157, Battle Creek, Michigan. Be the first around your part of town to own this real sundial wristwatch.
And now, back to the adventures of Superman. In his guise of Clark Kent, Superman is telling Lois Lane and Perry White of the last minutes on the doomed planet Krypton. How his father, Jor-El, had just completed an experimental model of a spaceship when a strange blood-red glow appeared in the sky and a series of thunderous crashes and deep rumbles, increasing in intensity, shook the ground under the feet of Jor-El and Lara, his young wife.
Lara, this is the end. Krypton is breaking apart.
What can we do, Jor-El?
Oh, nothing. I was a fool for waiting this long.
Oh, it wasn't your fault, Jor-El. The council...
Oh, I should have built a spaceship months ago, and now we have only a model. Oh, but wait. It can carry one of us to safety. You, Lara.
No. No, if only one of us can be saved, it should be our son. You wait here, I'll get him.
Lara! Lara! No, perhaps she's right. It should be the boy. Oh, now, if I can only get this atomic generator working, build up enough pressure, I hope there's time. There.
Jor-El.
Yes?
Here he is, still fast asleep.
Here, I'll open the door. Now, put him inside, gently.
Jor-El, are you sure?
Hurry, hurry, Lara.
He's in, Jor-El.
Here, good. Now, stand back, Lara. Pressure's building up.
How long will it take?
Oh, I don't know.
Look, The Temple of Wisdom's on fire. All the towers are crumbling.
Here, come close to me, Lara. The end is not far off. The mountains are breaking up.
Jor-El, the pressure. What's happening?
It's building up slowly. Perhaps we're too late if it doesn't happen soon. Lara, it's gone. Our son is on his way to Earth.
Screaming through space, the tiny steel rocket headed toward Earth, leaving the glowing fragments of the exploding planet Krypton behind it.
Good heavens, Clark.
Go on, Kent. That baby in the rocket, it was Superman, wasn't it?
Yes, Chief. That is, he grew up to be the person we know as Superman. And now I'm going to tell you and Lois what happened to him and why I need your help so desperately. You see, Jor-El had set the directional finders on the tiny rocket ship bearing his infant son toward this planet, Earth.
A strange expression on his face. Clark Kent begins to tell Perry White and Lois Lane what happened to himself. What is the rest of the fabulous saga of Superman? And is Kent, now in such grave danger, actually going to reveal at last that he is Superman? Don't miss tomorrow's exciting episode, fellows and girls. Tune in, same time, same station, and listen to The Adventures of Superman.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Superman.
Fellas and girls, be sure to follow The Adventures of Superman. Brought to you every day, Monday through Friday. Same time, same station. By the makers of that super delicious cereal, Kellogg's Pep. And for other thrilling adventures of Superman, see your local newspaper. Superman is also a copyrighted feature appearing in Superman DC publications. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Next up on Storytime is Sergei Prokofiev with Peter and the Wolf, read by Patrick Stewart. Peter and the Wolf was composed in 1936 and became a huge hit. And it is a symphonic fairy tale for children. It was written again in 1936 in one of the most frequently performed works in the entire classical repertoire. Recorded many, many times, I listened to this in music class as a kid. I remember listening to this in music class as a kid, and we all had parts, and Peter and the Wolf. I think I got to play Peter, as a matter of fact. I got to be Peter, man. Pretty awesome. Didn't want to be the duck. Anyway, listen in. Story time.
This is the story of Peter and the Wolf. Each character in this tale is represented by a different instrument of the orchestra. The bird, by the flute. The duck, by the oboe. By the clarinet, the grandfather by the bassoon. The Wolf by the Three Horns. Peter by the strings of the orchestra. Rifle shots by the kettle drum and the big drum. Early one morning, Peter opened the gate and went out into the big green meadow. Thank you. On a branch of a big tree sat a little bird, Peter's friend. All is quiet, chirped the bird gaily. Just then, a duck came waddling round. She was glad that Peter had not closed the gate and decided to take a nice swim in the deep pond in the meadow. Seeing the duck, the little bird flew down upon the grass, settled next to her, and shrugged his shoulders. "What kind of a bird are you if you can't fly?" said he. To this, the duck replied, "What kind of a bird are you if you can't swim?" and dived into the pond. Argued and argued, the duck swimming in the pond, the little bird hopping along the shore. Suddenly, something caught Peter's attention. He noticed a cat crawling through the grass. Thought, the bird is busy arguing. I'll just grab him. Stealthily, she crept towards him on her velvet paws. "Look out!" shouted Peter. and the bird immediately flew up into the tree. While the duck quacked angrily at the cat, from the middle of the pond. The cat walked round the tree and thought, "Is it worth climbing up so high? By the time I get there, the bird will have flown away." Grandfather came out. He was angry because Peter had gone into the meadow. "It is a dangerous place. If a wolf should come out of the forest, then what would you do?" Peter paid no attention to his grandfather's words. Boys like him are not afraid of wolves. Grandfather took Peter by the hand, locked the gate, and led him home. Sooner had Peter gone than a big gray wolf came out of the forest. Twinkling, the cat climbed up the tree. The duck quacked and, in her excitement, jumped out of the pond. But no matter how hard the duck tried to run, she couldn't escape the wolf. He was getting nearer, nearer, catching up with her. And then he got her and with one gulp swallowed her. And now, this is how things stood. The cat was sitting on one branch. The bird on another. Not too close to the cat. And the wolf walked round and round the tree, looking at them with greedy eyes. In the meantime, Peter, without the slightest fear, stood behind the closed gate watching all that was going on. He ran home, got a strong rope, and climbed up the high stone wall. One of the branches of the tree around which the wolf was walking stretched out over the wall. Grabbing hold of the branch, Peter lightly climbed over onto the tree. Peter said to the bird, "Fly down and circle round the wolf's head. Only take care that he doesn't catch you." The bird almost touched the wolf's head with his wings, while the wolf snapped angrily at him from this side and that. How the bird did worry the wolf, how he wanted to catch him. But the bird was cleverer, and the wolf simply couldn't do anything about it. Meanwhile, Peter made a lasso and carefully letting it down. Caught the wolf by the tail and pulled with all his might. Feeling himself caught, the wolf began to jump wildly, trying to get loose. But Peter tied the other end of the rope to the tree. And the wolf's jumping only made the rope round his tail tighter. Just then, the hunters came out of the woods. Following the wolf's trail and shooting as they went. Peter, sitting in the tree, said, "Don't shoot. Birdie and I have caught the wolf. Now help us to take him to the zoo." Thank you.
Imagine the triumphant procession. Peter at the head. After him, the hunters leading the wolf. Winding up the procession, Grandfather and the cat. Grandfather tossed his head discontentedly. Well, and if Peter hadn't caught the wolf, what then? Above them flew Birdie, chirping merrily. My, what brave fellows we are, Peter and I. Look what we have caught. If you listen very carefully, you can hear the duck quacking inside the wolf, because the wolf in his hurry had swallowed her alive.
WMFO Medford, Massachusetts. You're listening to Time Travel with Chris Earle. I'm here with you until 7 p.m. Thanks for listening to Freeform Radio.
I'll tell you about the worst job I ever had in my life. Worst job I ever had in my life was working for the... was it the Santa Fe? Yeah, it was the Santa Fe Railroad, south of Las Vegas, Nevada. Yeah, that's the old Mormon Muddy Mission, you see. It's way out in what the Navajos call the boonies. Out in the desert. Now, the job was Gandhi dancing. Now, Gandhi dancing used to be in the old days. Gandhi dancing was when the Irish were building the railroad. Of course, the first transcontinental railroad was built by Irish laborers. And they used these long-handled shovels called Irish banjos that were made by the Gandhi Shovel Company of Chicago. Now, the Irish laborer would take the wide end of the shovel when he could find it, and he would jam it in under a rail or a tie, and he would climb out on the long handle, do a little jig step out there, and that would lever the tie up or the rail up, and you push gravel in underneath it and tamp it down, and that levels the roadbed. See, that's what Gandhi dancing is. Leveling the roadbed so the damn train doesn't fall off as it goes by, which is just a big drag for everybody. Now, they don't do Gandhi dancing the normal way anymore, see. Like they did in the old days. Nowadays, they run three cars out on the line. They run a box car out there that's a bunk car. You sleep in it. Got bunks in there 18 inches apart. And then you got a tool car with your tamping irons and your tongs and your double jack hammers and spikes and all of that equipment, see, to do the job. And then you got a cook car. I mean, there's no restaurants anyplace around, so you got a cook car. Pots and pans and a coal or wood-burning stove and a long table down the middle to eat at. Only thing they don't hire is a cook. That's because they're cheap. Saves them money. Rule is that in that crew, they're supposed to pick among their own members who's going to be the cook. Now, they don't try to do it sensibly, like draw lots or decide who the best cook is. What they do is they wait and find out who bitches and whines and pisses and moans the most about the cooking. And they say, "All right, wise guy, you think you can do better, you get to be the cook." Well, that was me, see. Old alligator mouth. The new man on the crew. And that was the worst food I'd ever had. I mean, it was dog bottom pie and pheasant sweat. Otter water. Comes out of an otter. It's a terrible, terrible stuff. Some people might think it's a delicacy, but I thought it was garp. So I complained, and they said, "All right, wise guy, you get to be the cook." That made me mad, because I didn't want to cook. But I knew if anybody complained about my cooking, that they were going to have to cook. Armed with that knowledge, I sallied forth over the muddy river. I was walking around among the cheat grass and bunch grass there, and I looked down, and there was just a hell of a big moose turd. Biggest damn moose turd. That was a real steamer, damn. I looked down at that meadow wafer, and I said to myself, "Self, I'm going to bake up a big moose turd pie. Because if anybody complains about my cooking, they're going to have to cook." So I tipped that pasture pastry up on edge. I got my shit together, so to speak. And I started rolling it down toward the old cook car. Bloom, bloom. I got it down there and leaned it up against the side, and I climbed up in the cook car and I baked up a hell of a big pie shell. And I baked that moose turd in it as slick as you please. And I crimped the edges with my thumbs and laid strips of dough across it and garnished it with a sprig of parsley, a little paprika. It was beautiful. Poetry on a plate. And I served it for dessert, waiting for the first hint of a complaint. Well, this giant dude come in, about 5'40". I mean, he was big. Throwed himself down like a fool on the stool. Picked up his fork. Took a big bite of that moose turd pie. Well, he threw down his fork, and he let out a beller, and he yelled, "My God, that's moose turd pie!" It's good, though.
Man named Utah Phillips from his album It's Good, Though, with Moose Turd Pie. I like that one. That was kind of a fun one. It was from Dr. Demento from years ago.
America, your children have an amazing superpower. They can help save lives by not having playdates. That's right. By replacing get-togethers with virtual playdates and video chats, they can help slow the evil spread of germs. And if your superheroes do go outside, make sure they continue their superhero wing by staying 6 feet away from others to protect everyone in America land. Find out more at coronavirus.gov. A message from the CDC and the Ad Council.
I'm going to leave you with some Star Trek. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, from the read-along version. The guy that does Kirk is kind of funny. And it's fun to kind of hear the different voiceovers that they pick for this kid's tale for Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Here you go.
This is the story of The Wrath of Khan. You can read along with me in your book. You will know it is time to turn the page when you hear the communicator beep like this. Let's begin now. Space, the final frontier. These are the continuing voyages of the Starship Enterprise. A new crew was being trained on the Enterprise. The ship's new captain, Mr. Spock, asked Admiral James Kirk to observe the crew's first training flight. He greeted his old friend when he came aboard.
How are you feeling, Admiral?
Useless, Spock. I feel old and useless. I shouldn't be working behind a desk on Earth. I should be out here in space.
Meanwhile, light years away, Commander Chekov searched for a test site for an important scientific experiment codenamed Genesis. He and Captain Terrell of the Starship Reliant beamed down to investigate a lifeless desert planet. Chekov saw something through the wind-blown sand.
A ruined spaceship! What is it doing here?
The two men entered the wreck through its airlock. Instantly, a muscular white-haired man seized Chekov, lifting him into the air with one hand. Chekov's eyes bulged.
It's Khan! Captain Terrell! He's a criminal! He once tried to steal the Enterprise.
Khan smiled chillingly.
Yes. And as punishment, Captain James T. Kirk marooned me and my people here 15 years ago. I've stayed alive all this time for one reason. I mean to avenge myself upon him.
Khan lowered Chekov.
Why have you come to this planet?
I'll never tell you.
You'll tell me anything I want to know.
Khan carefully removed two tiny, wiggling creatures from a sealed container.
These are SETI eels. When I put them in your ear, they will allow me to control your mind.
Chekov and Terrell shivered as Khan approached them with the squirming eels. Once Khan had control over their minds, he forced Terrell to give him command of the Reliant. Then he made Chekov radio Dr. Carol Marcus, the scientist in charge of the Genesis Project.
The planet has checked out, and we have new orders. We're coming to pick up the Genesis device for immediate testing.
That can't be, Commander. Who gave the orders?
Khan made Chekov answer.
Admiral James T. Kirk.
Admiral Kirk inspected the Enterprise before she took off on her training flight. He smiled at the chief engineer.
Is everything shipshape, Mr. Scott?
Scotty patted the powerful engines lovingly.
Aye, Admiral. She'll take anything you can throw at her. Even trainees.
Suddenly, the intercom blared.
Urgent message for Admiral Kirk.
Kirk dashed to his quarters and flicked on the view screen. It was Dr. Marcus. The message faded in and out, as if it were being jammed.
Take Genesis away from us.
Then the picture went dead. Kirk called Sulu on the bridge.
There's something wrong at the Genesis lab. Plot a course for Regular One.
As the starship leaped into warp drive, Kirk went to Captain Spock's quarters.
Spock, there's trouble. Regulations require me to take command of the ship. I'm sorry, I know she's yours now, but...
Spock raised an eyebrow.
Don't apologize, old friend. Logically, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Besides, I have no feelings to hurt.
As they neared Regula One, Spock reported.
The Reliant is closing on us, Admiral. She won't respond to our communications.
Suddenly, the Reliant's phasers blasted into the Enterprise's engine room. Kirk shouted into the intercom.
Scotty! Damage report!
Admiral, the main power is out. The warp engines are wrecked. Whoever's on that ship knew just where to hit us.
A face appeared on the bridge view screen. Kirk couldn't believe his eyes. It was Khan.
Ah, Admiral. I see you still recognize me after all these years.
What do you want, Khan?
I want your life, Kirk. However, I'll spare your crew if your computer transmits all your data on the Genesis Project.
Agreed.
Kirk turned away from the screen with a secret smile. Spock whispered to Kirk.
Admiral, you can't give him Genesis.
I won't, Spock. I'll use our computer to lower his shield so we can fire back.
Rapidly, Kirk programmed the computer, then turned to face Khan.
Get ready to receive our transmission.
The computer sent out its signal, and Reliant shields dropped.
Fire phasers, Mr. Sulu.
The blast exploded into Reliant. Heavily damaged, Khan's ship had to retreat into space, while the wounded Enterprise leapt onwards towards the Genesis lab orbiting Regula One. Commander Uhura tried to contact the lab, but the only response was an eerie silence. Kirk made a decision.
Khan's been there. I'm beaming down. Dr. McCoy, come with me. People may be hurt. Mr. Spock, the ship is yours.
Once aboard the empty station, the landing party found Terrell and Chekov.
Admiral, Khan controlled our minds, used us to trick you. But he didn't get the Genesis device. It was gone when he arrived.
Kirk examined the lab's transporter.
The controls are set for Regula. I think Dr. Marcus took the Genesis device down there.
Stepping into the transporter, they beam down to the tiny planet. The group materialized in a cave deep inside Regula. There they found the scientists from the space lab and the Genesis device. Instantly, Terrell and Chekov drew their phasers. Khan's voice crackled from their communicators.
You lose, Admiral. These men are still my puppets. I'm taking Genesis, but first I'm going to have Mr. Chekov.
But Chekov desperately fought Khan's control. He threw down his phaser and fell unconscious. Dr. McCoy examined him and found the SETI eel in his ear. With a shudder, he destroyed it. Khan's transporter snatched the Genesis device. Kirk grabbed his communicator.
Khan, you missed again. I'm still alive.
Khan growled back.
Buried alive, Admiral. I'm going to destroy your ship. No one will ever find you.
McCoy threw up his hands.
Would someone please explain to me what the Genesis device is?
Dr. Marcus led them all into a tremendous cavern full of trees and flowers.
Genesis created this in a day. It turns dead rock into life forms. It could do the same to a planet. But everything already living on the planet would die. It would make a horrifying weapon.
Kirk's communicator chirped.
Spock here, Admiral. The Reliant is approaching. We're going to beam you up.
Moments later, Kirk was on board.
Spock, what's our situation?
We have partial power, but Khan can still outrun us and outshoot us.
I see one chance. If we fly into the Mutara Nebula, Khan's shields and sensors won't work.
With the Reliant chasing close behind, the Enterprise headed into the nebula. The vast clouds of gas and dust blinded the two captains as they hunted each other. Suddenly, Kirk's view screen cleared.
Reliant's coming straight at us. Evasive starboard.
The ships exchanged tremendous phaser blasts. The Enterprise was hit.
Fire photon torpedoes.
The torpedoes shot away and blasted into the Reliant, nearly ripping her apart. The Reliant hung dead in space, a battered hulk. Kirk had Uhura open a communications channel.
Khan, surrender and prepare to be boarded.
Khan, badly injured, crawled to the Genesis device.
No, Kirk. The game's not over. To the last, I will grapple with thee.
With his last strength, he armed the deadly machine. Spock checked his instruments.
There's an unusual energy source on the Reliant. Admiral Kirk, he's armed the Genesis device.
Kirk called the engine room.
Scotty, I need warp speed in 3 minutes or we're all dead.
Impossible, Admiral. The energizer's shaken loose. There's a radiation leak and I can't get in to fix it.
As the Enterprise limped slowly away from the Reliant, Spock leaped up and raced to engineering. Scotty stopped him as he started into the reactor room.
No! The radiation is too strong. It will kill anyone who goes in there.
Pushing Scotty aside, Spock rushed into the deadly room and began the necessary repairs. Kirk couldn't take his eyes away from the burning Reliant.
We aren't going to make it. Status report, Mr. Chekov.
Admiral, main energy just came back online.
Bless you. Go, Mr. Sulu.
The Enterprise jumped to warp speed just as the Genesis device exploded. With a surge of power, the mighty starship left the explosion far behind. Dr. McCoy called the bridge.
Jim, you'd better get down here. Hurry.
When Kirk arrived in engineering, he found Spock in the reactor room, dying.
Don't grieve, Jim. It's logical. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. I have been, and always will be, your friend. Live long and prosper.
Kirk could only stare helplessly through the glass as his friend fell. The casket containing Spock's body was shot into space. It landed on the new planet created by the explosion of the Genesis device. As the Enterprise pulled away toward home, Kirk gazed back at his friend's resting place. Dr. McCoy turned to him.
You okay, Jim? How do you feel?
Kirk thought about the new planet, bursting with new life and new possibilities. He smiled.
Young. I feel young.
Due to COVID-19, WMFO DJs are pre-recording their shows for broadcast on air. We can still accept phone calls, but the phone line is in voicemail mode. Call 855-915-9636 and be sure to leave the DJ's name in the voicemail so we can forward it to the correct person. The following program was recorded earlier. Enjoy. Enjoy.